Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Limar Technical Net. Limar Technical Net has been going strong for over 42 years, mostly under the guidance of Vic, K2RIW. Unfortunately, became a silent key a few years ago. So in his memory, we continue the Limar Technical Net in order to inform each other, learn from each other, teach each other, and entertain each other. So I hope we will accomplish all three tonight. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you the usual link. Okay. If you want to reach me and you can't do it via the radio, email is a good idea. That would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions, so the questions that you couldn't, that would naturally be asked during the technical net, but if you couldn't be here on the radio, this was a way of asking the question and then either listening through our stream or some other service or listening to the archive recorded. Also, if you have a topic of interest, you could either want to present it yourself, or you could want to be part of the discussion, or you could want to sit that back and listen to other people talk about it. That's a reason. Also, if you have a puzzle, I have a couple of very, very small ones in my back pocket, which I hope to show people tonight. I'm always looking for them, preferably puzzles that can't be Googled in a fraction of a second. So if you have them, please share. And also, if you want to have Paul take a look at something space or NASA related, you can send me the email and I'll poke him on the shoulder and tell him what you want to look have him look at. Now, the email address for me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to directly email Paul, he's available at spacenetreport@gmail.com. So keep that in mind. I have a link page, all kinds of interesting articles, YouTubes. I have a lovely picture of our son with a big smile on his face. You can get there by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. That'll get you to the link page, and it's available all the time. So you don't necessarily have to go run into it today. You could do it next week, next month. It'll be there. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's very busy, sometimes it's very quiet. The way to get to it is to type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you there. Let me drop for a second. Okay. We offer an audio stream for people who are not able to pick up our radio signal tonight. And because some people asked, I leave it on the rest of the week. So if you want to listen into Glen Oak, you just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you an audio stream. And as always, I'd like to remind people that Mike, AC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It's had over a million visitors. And it has archives of our Limar technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So we benefit from the wisdom of people who moved away or passed away. They offer a great deal of wisdom. Technology doesn't really change that much, so it's a very good source of information. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay. So we will ask for people with questions or comments or topics of interest. We will make a list, and hopefully the first few will be amateur radio related, but as the night progresses, we'll open it up for just about any aspect of science and technology. As I mentioned, I have two very, very small puzzlers that hopefully I'll be able to share with you people tonight. So that's the plan. Anyone want to check in, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Zulu.
This is Raymond at WW2RG.
Okay, Rich, W2BZ. I caught the trailing Z of your identifier, but since I know your voice so well, I knew it was you. Raymond, WW2RG, recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
What do you see? I sent you mails. I hope you saw it.
Yes, I did, Wesley. You know, it saddens me when an amateur radio operator does a YouTube video and he doesn't quite get the audio very well. I mean, he had different scenes, and some of them were decently mic'd, but some of them really were badly mic'd. I don't know why Ham's sent to do that. I've seen far too many amateur radio YouTubes out there where the poor guys just didn't mic themselves correctly.
I think this is because many of those talented ham radio operators are older guys, retirees. Not all of them are fluent with. They don't want to spend money for the program, not knowing that such one is probably involved. Also, there is a group of people who is illiterate or not very much interested in computer. I have some work.
I don't know if it's quite that. I think it's problematic at the very get-go of miking properly. What I think some amateur radio operators tend to do is they rely on their in-camera mic, wherever that camera might be, and they don't appreciate the fact that, you know, if you take it out in a windy day, it's going to have a lot of wind in the background. If you put the camera too far away from your mouth, you're going to have reverb and other things. And then when they get the final copy, they say, it's good enough, I guess. I wish they put a little bit more value into production values. So I think it's even before the level of video editing. It's just simple mic practices that as amateur radio operators, I'm sure they're aware of, but they don't kind of carry it on when a camera is involved for some odd reason.
Yeah. So if I could do a quick summary of those videos. The reason for one of them was 177 feet tower, serving as 160-meter antenna, vertical antenna. They used L-shaped support that was first lifted up and then attached to the peak tower, used a lever. So that technique was kind of very much clever for me. So that's the few words about it, if you remember that.
Okay, Wesley, we'll get to that in a little while. You're in the number three slot. I don't want the number one and number two to have to wait. So we'll get to you soon. I just wanted to take this opportunity to ask if anyone else wants to be put on the list for tonight. Please hit that push to talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, nothing much heard. Hopefully, as time goes on, there'll be more people with more comments, questions, topics. Rich, W2BZ, what's your question or your comment for tonight, Rich?
Hello there, Roy, and hello everybody else who's listening. Welcome to time changeover again. Why don't they keep it the way it was? I don't get it. Anyway, you have been extolling the virtues of 10 meters lately, so I dusted off my SDR Play 1A, and I was listening around on 10. I didn't hear much, you know, of great value. The signals I did hear were sort of just above the noise level, but it got me thinking, since a dipole for 10 meters is only 16 feet long, in my limited HOA space, I could manage that. The problem is, I can't get it higher than 8 to 10 feet off the ground. So my question is, am I fooling myself because of my height restriction, or do you think I might be able to get some use out of, you know, a dipole cut to the correct frequency, but only 8 to 10 feet off the ground? Back to you.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously it depends upon what time of day that you're on 10 meters. If you're on in the middle of the night, you're not going to really hear much. Today was decent. It wasn't as active as last week, which is probably a good thing because it was so active that I couldn't find an open frequency to have my small little club net on. Today there was about 8 or 9 conversations going on 10 meters, and I heard Europe a lot at 10:30 and so. Then I heard a lot of people talking in Spanish. I don't know if it was Central America or South America. So they're out there. Getting back to your question, 10 meters, theoretically you want the sweet spot is one half of the band of the wavelength. So one half of the wavelength of 10 meters is 5 meters. Doing quick and dirty transformation, that's roughly 15 feet. So 10 feet is decent. It's not optimum. Optimum would be about 15, 16 feet, but certainly 10 feet would get you out. If your choice is between 8 or 10, I would go with the 10, obviously, for reasons. But it won't be a completely near vertical incident sky wave. The closer you get it to a 15 or 16 feet off the ground, the better your DXing will be.
Okay, and I am assuming that if I cut it to about to 16.2 feet. If I cut it exactly on 16.2 feet, and of course cut it in half, should I not have, at the middle of the band, should I not have, by definition, by physics, should I not have a one-to-one SWR?
Well, I wish life was as simple as that, Rich. There is so many things complicating resonance of antennas, coupling with the ground, coupling with nearby things, that you might find that you have to tweak them a little bit. So it's always best to cut long and then make them shorter, because it's a lot easier to do that than the other way around.
Yeah, I have a Kenwood 440, so I was thinking of using the SDR Play 1A to find signals and then trying to connect with those people with, I think that would be a smart way to use the SDR receiver. I know I've asked you this before. I'm not quite clear on the bias T. What is that, and what is?
Okay, this is AT2GS. By the way, every so often you cut out for about a second. A bias T is simply a means to power an active device. So what happens is, the T has a source of power. So you have a radio, you have an active device, and the transmission line going to the active device. Now you have to inject some kind of DC signal to power up the active device. So that's what a bias T is about. If you do have an active device there, you have to be very cautious. You can't use that line to transmit on, because that will fry your active device. So you'd probably need something like a TR switch to kind of cross between the two. But that's what that is.
I can hear, there's not much difference if I turn off bias T or not. I think that's powering that little audio amplifier that comes with the loop antenna, that cheap but very, very efficient loop antenna that I forgot the model number, but it's only about $30 on Amazon, and a lot of people use that for receive only. So why do I hear such a small difference when whether, you know, bias T is on or off.
Well, most likely because it's a cheap amplifier. These things are low noise RF amplifiers. They sort of are a fudge factor for untuned loop antennas. I had a loop antenna that I'm now DX Engineering sells. It's designed to be like that. It's locked in at a certain frequency, so it's non-resonant for a great deal, and it makes up for it theoretically by energizing a very sophisticated high-gain, low-noise RF amplifier that's probably added $100, $150 to the price of the device. I assume the Chinese design is not as robust, so it's giving you some gain, but not a great deal.
All right. Yeah, that's about it. I was wondering why there was so little difference with bias T on or off. Other than that, I'll give it a try. I like the fact that the sunspot cycle is going in our direction, and who knows? I mean, I didn't hear as many signals as you did this afternoon, Roy, but the low end of the band with CW was really humming. There were a lot of CW activity on the low end of 10 meters. That's promising. Now I just have to build myself a tier. So, all right, that's it. Thanks, Roy. W2BC, back to net.
Okay, I wish you good luck, Rich. Like I said, 10 meters generally is jumping. Obviously, it jumps more during the dawn to dusk than at night. It's kind of dead once again once the F2 layer kind of dissipates. But it's been consistently good, sometimes great, sometimes just good. I talked to Texas today, and as I mentioned, I heard Europe earlier before I started to transmit. So they're out there, thankfully, and you just got to grab them. So once again, I wish you luck. Next on my list for tonight is Raymond, WW2RG. Raymond, what's your question, comment, or topic?
Yeah, thank you. Good evening to all. We're going to be talking about an HF antenna. I have a Comet CH250, and I'm basically going to be moving it from New York down to Virginia. Now, the question is basically, in Virginia where I'm going to be setting it up, it's going to be up on a hill, but the backside of the hill drops off at like a 45-degree angle. Does anyone have any experience with setting up an antenna like this and not having the near-ground vertical type compensation you get from the antenna?
Okay, not quite sure the totality of the question is. Usually, it's a good thing to elevate even a vertical. They're less important than certainly horizontals because of ground coupling and absorption and such. But it's still usually, as far as I'm aware, a good thing to elevate even a vertical. So I'm not quite sure what you're expecting the ground to give you as an advantage for your 250.
Basically, I've always understood that the HF antenna wants to be on level ground. And like I said, if you go from half the antenna, I should say placement of the land is flat in the first part of it, but towards the back end of the property, it slopes off. And I'm going to be putting this antenna right at that location where it drops off. I was just wondering if anyone has any experience with having a vertical antenna that is not on a flat piece of property, but maybe on a slope.
Okay, I'm somewhat familiar. I think it's the CHA-250. Does that have radials or not?
No, it does not.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so it's not a matter of the radials will determine propagation. Anyone out there with any experience with something like the CHA-250 on uneven ground? Once again, this is AC2GS, and Raymond here, WW2RG, is planning to move his CHA-250 to Virginia on uneven ground, and he wants to know if anyone has had any experience with verticals mounted in a situation where the terra firma kind of runs down off a cliff on one side. Does it introduce? I would be amazed if it actually does introduce a significant degree of directionality for its radiation pattern. Fortunately, the only way that you're going to really know for sure is to walk around with a signal meter. But if anyone out there has any experience with situations like this, please share.
NY2A.
Yes, Tony.
I don't have experience with it, but I would go along with your assumption, because the CHA-250 is a broadband antenna, and it's basically it is actually a 5-to-1 transformer that's the base of it that gives it broadband. Broadbandedness, which is why it doesn't have radios. And you can actually add radios to that antenna, but I would not expect with such a broadband, relatively lossy antenna, that any change in the ground level or something would really make much of a difference.
Yeah, we're both in agreement. The problem, as I see it, with the 250 is that that balun is a rather lossy balun. I have heard people discuss the heat dissipation, and so therefore the power dissipation. So the efficiency of the CHA-250, I don't think is terribly good, but I don't see how ground conditions are going to introduce too much change in the pattern, certainly discernible, but it'll be interesting. I, once again, if anyone else has anything to input on this subject, because, you know, most of our antennas in the metropolitan area are at least somewhat symmetrical. We do have that going for us.
W2BC?
Yes, Rich. Yes, Rich?
Just on the topic of verticals without radials, that's my problem. I can't lay out any kind of good pattern with radials. So are there efficient verticals without radials for it?
Well, like most compromised cases, the quick and dirty answer is no, there aren't. You either get an efficient device with radials or an inefficient device without radials. There's a couple of different ways of getting around radials. With the CHA-250, it's the lossy balun. There's another method by building a half-wave antennas, and for that, unfortunately, you need a relatively lossy 49-to-1 balun, but that gets you out of trouble of radials. Usually highly efficient antennas that require radials. You can have them sort of kind of run, but not very well.
How does the balun take the place of radials? How does that work?
Well, to a degree, unfortunately, it kind of hides the mismatch. It basically just soaks up so much of the power that your reflected power, if it was a more efficient design, would give you a higher SWR. But since those balances, sometimes I think they soak up something close to half of the power that you put in there. The return reflected power is relatively low, and your SWR meter says, yeah, sure, that works for me, and so you go with a very low efficient transmission.
that seems like a, you know, like a pretty big trade-off. Half of the power is being lost in place of radios, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what tends to happen. If you read up a lot on the CH-250, and there are other companies making similar type of designs, where people will actually measure the temperature, the thermal loss, and all kinds of wonderful demonstrations of the limitations. You sort of see the same concept in, we talked earlier about traveling wave antennas, in which about half of, there are two types of antennas that we talked about before. There are standing wave antennas, which about 99% of us use, and then there are traveling wave antennas. And the reason they're called traveling wave is because rather than the RF going back and forth and back and forth and slowly just being emitted from the antenna, they only go in one direction, then they go into a load, and they get turned into heat. So the benefit of the traveling wave is because there's very little reflected power. It's all either being emitted or being turned into heat at terminating load of the traveling wave antenna. That when you look at your standing wave ratio meter again, it reads a pretty good SWR because it bases it on the percentage of forward versus reflected power. And traveling waves have very little in the way of reflected power. So it's sort of the same thing going on, only without a proper resistor. Instead of a resistor, you have a lossy balance.
Is there any way to figure out how much in signal loss, actual signal loss, dB loss you're looking at with a non-radial vertical?
I wish there was, and if there was, everyone would be more informed and more depressed. We measure what we can measure. We can measure watts very easily. We can measure impedance mismatches either by measuring the impedance properly with something like a vector network analyzer, or we can infer it assuming little reflected transmission line loss and looking at the reflected versus forward power. Ultimately, efficiency is one of the very important aspects of an antenna that 99.9% of hams cannot measure. You would have to put it in an anechoic chamber, and you would have to have someone wander around with a signal strength meter to kind of get a good idea of how much energy is going out and how much it isn't in order to get the efficiency.
But gee, I guess you couldn't even make a guesstimation on if you're losing half the power going into the antenna on the other end. Does that mean that, you know, your signal strength is going to go from an S9 to an S4? I mean, I guess there's no way to even come close to, I'm sure the antenna manufacturers like, so they don't have to advertise it, but I guess there's no way to come close to actual signal loss.
AC2GS, no, that's the problem. That's why everyone talks about SWR, because that's the one thing that you could measure pretty good, all things being equal. You cannot measure efficiency almost at all. You know, if you're in the military and can afford millions of dollars of test equipment, yes, you can. If you're a ham and you want to know how good your particular antenna is, you tend to calculate based on who you contact. If you are able to talk to people far away and hear people far away, then it's a good antenna and it works for you. And you don't really discuss things like efficiency. But just getting back to decibels and S meter readings, and we've talked about this before. The standard calibration for an meter is each S unit is 6 dB of gain or loss. So a half of the power. If your transmissions are cut in half, the guy on the other end who's talking to you is only going to discern at most a one-half S unit change. That's all that 3 decibels or half power will elicit.
Oh, well, if that's the case, it seems like a vertical, you're not taking that big a hit in the real world with a vertical without radials.
Well, you know, I guess so. But, you know, everyone would kind of like to have a perfectly tuned, resident, highly efficient antenna. You know, I mean, a lot of people argue numbers that are somewhat meaningless. You know, there are guys out there who will put in a day's work to get their antenna at a 1-to-1 as opposed to a 1.1-to-1, where the difference in the signal strength is not visible on anyone's S meter, even 1.2 or even 1.3, probably not. But there are guys out there who will put in all that effort because a number is still a number.
What about a 2-to-1 versus a 1.0-to-1?
Well, you know, I'd have to look up the tables. It's not quite as bad as probably most people think. I would assume that if your transmitter didn't cough up a furball having to work into a 100-ohm impedance as opposed to a 50-ohm impedance, you might get something like a 10-15% loss. At Ham Radio University, we had a slideshow about test equipment and such, and one of them was, you know, what the SWR versus decibel loss was. But unfortunately, I haven't memorized it. But it's not really that significant. It's more problematic for your electronic equipment that are kind of high strung and really want to see that 50 ohm impedance at the other end.
Food for thought for all us HOAers out here. All right, thanks, Roy.
How do I do it?
Raymond, I'm sorry, we didn't seem to elicit much experience on unlevel ground versus vertical.
No problem. Once I set it up in about 2 months, I'll report back if I find anything outstanding on it. But for everybody else to understand, I've been utilizing this for about a year now on level property, being about 25 feet up in the air. And I've been able to reach into from Long Island all the way into Germany, some parts of Russia, and a lot of parts of South America with it.
Okay, very good. I mean, in the end, whether it's not the most efficient design, doesn't have the greatest takeoff angle, if it works, it works. I repeatedly retell the story of a guy that wrote a book about antennas and went into antenna design and manufacturing, who, before he started doing that as an exercise in absurdity, he took a 100-watt light bulb, he put it on a fence post, and he got a workable state out of it. So if you have the determination and a little bit of good luck, a lot of antennas will work for you in one way or the other. So I'm glad that the CHA-250 is working for you. It is, to a degree, a popular antenna. I see it all over the place mentioned, with positives and negatives. But, you know, if it works for you, it works for you.
All right, this is WW2RG73 to all. Thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome, Raymond. I hope we hear back from you to hear the solution to this problem. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. We'll get to Wes in a second. Just interested if there's anyone else out there who wants to have their name on the list for tonight for any questions or comments or topics. If you do, hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Lou is in there, Roy.
Lou is in there? I did not hear him. Rich, were you trying to tell me that Lou NY2H was out there?
I heard him. Maybe it was just a Selden Glen Oaks aberration. Thought I heard him. Maybe not.
Okay, well, we'll try one more time. If anyone out there has any questions or comments or topics of discussion for tonight, please hit that push to talk button and to give me your call sign and your first name, and we'll put you on the list.
WB2KW3.
Okay, can recognize. Anyone else out there want to put your name down on the list? Okay, well, I guess we'll move on to Wes. Wes sent me some videos. They're interesting. I don't know if they were that particularly special, but Wesley, what do you want to talk about them? About?
Well, I had another station in there.
Okay, I did not. I heard Ken and no one else. So if anyone else out there wants to check in and go on the list, please transmit. Well, Paul, I'm not hearing anything here on Glen Oaks. Are you hearing something different?
Maybe it was another repeater or something. Somebody else is talking. All right, back to you, Wes.
Okay, I mean, I'm sure there'll be loads of time for all kinds of things. You know, we're not going away fast. So, Wes, you want to talk about these YouTube?
Yeah, I'm interested with some different kind of jokes. Those videos. One of them was 177 feet tower serving as 160 meter vertical antenna. And they used the L-shaped support that was first lifted up while the 177 feet tower was still on the ground. Then it was anchored somehow, and it was used as a lever. So the shorter part of the L shape was then pulled by the tractor, and that's how the bigger mass was elevated. But you probably would be able to say it more precisely and to HGN.
Well, I don't know. You pretty much explained it. These guys, I kind of detached from reality when you factor in the surface area that they were working in, the number of people that were doing it, and the number of heavy equipment that they were using. So I don't identify with any of that. But yeah, it was a big effort. It was they put that up in France someplace. It looked like a very nicely manicured piece of land, and it's a monster of a vertical. Again, I can't identify with any of that. I mean, I got the usual Brooklyn lot that's 100 by 20 feet, so you couldn't begin to put that even on the ground that he had winched up the way those guys did.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to calculate what is the angle connection. So you have 177 feet tower lying on the ground. Then you're putting approximately 60, maybe 80 meters, 3 feet in meters. Okay, so you're putting much shorter. Part of the L, you're elevating it to vertical, and then when you anchor both together, so it creates solid L. Can you imagine what is the force? What is the force at that L? Because then they're using the shorter part of L to attach the top of the shorter part to the tractor, and the tractor is actually pulling that shorter part from the top, making this the vertical, elevating to the vertical position. Can you imagine how much force, how much strength that was? And to actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things while I was watching it was, gee, this is really dangerous. Unless they got a structural engineer as part of those guys in the background, I wouldn't be you know, within a mile of that place. Because metal fatigue can snap something in half, and then all those forces flying about are very dangerous. So I didn't really read anything useful about, you know, whether these guys just got together, whether they're trained in such things, whether they do this on every weekend, or how it came to pass. But the amount of structural forces involved, as you mentioned, can be very dangerous.
So this is one part of the problem from technicality standpoint. But the second problem is a vertical antenna that has to be isolated from the ground. And I was looking at that video, and there was something like a white color or gray color horizontal plate that serves as an isolator, I assume. It's like you have your vertical dipole mounted on the chassis of your car. The chassis isolated from the antenna, the chassis serves as a counterpoint. So now, after they lifted up all of the structure that was humongously heavy, they have this thin piece, it was probably 5 inches thick, of insulator material that didn't break during all of that procedure, and now it must serve. Did you notice that?
Well, I don't know if they got lucky or they were just smart, because I couldn't find any particular documentation of the people involved in the design and of this. So I have no clue whether they just got lucky. I got the sense that it went up, because I think if it failed and killed someone, they wouldn't be making a YouTube about it. But that was kind of all that I guessed about it.
Okay, so that was the first video. None of them was really looking like some kind of engineer. It was rather like a ham radio operator who is a farmer with few of his friends. And very little amount of people was trying to elevate that. Unbelievable. Now, the next one is F8FKI and its friend. Oh, I'm sorry. So so F8FKI, that's the 160-meter band in France. So that was in France. Now, the next one, we have M Radio Balloon Launch. And a few words about it. It was K5PRK and K5RWK. They decided to launch those two clubs, a ham radio balloon, with number of payloads, where was ham radio antenna, crossband repeater, DMR simplex repeater, LoRa, APR, tracker, and a few other items. So if you, Dr. Roy, can say a few words about LoRa, EMR. I'm pretty sure everybody knows it, but there might be someone who doesn't. Interesting.
This is an interesting branch of amateur radio. Whatever floats one's boat and interests them and pulls them into the hobby is great with me.
So I was on your top probably for a few minutes. Repeat again.
Okay, I said that the particular gentleman who does the podcast kind of rubs me in the wrong way. I get vibes of deliverance for some strange reason, but that the general concept of telemetry and putting radios in balloons is an interesting branch. And I mentioned that we had a visitor at my other club who was interested in getting his license so that he could run amateur radio frequency telemetry for his balloons and such.
WB2EAV Mobile.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I have other commitments. I just got in the car going from commitment A to commitment B. And I don't know, but I have worked on weather balloon transmitters and telemetry gear. So this is kind of like, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere, but if anybody, you know, wants to tap my brain, I am normally available, just not at this moment, maybe in about an hour.
Okay, Ed, we'll keep that in mind. At this point, Wes is just referring to a few interesting YouTubes that he saw over the past week.
All right, I just heard, you know, balloon transmitters, and to the street, I'd let you know.
Okay, very good. Dick, may rest in peace. He used to say that there's 57 different aspects of this hobby. There's probably 100 more. Doing telemetry and such is one of them. Whatever floats one's boat, I was not particularly. I used to like radio control airplanes. I don't think I was ever too much into weather balloons personally. But whatever works for you.
Oh, let me just say the following little teaser bits. I did work on telemetry receivers for missile range safety. You know, when they say, and they had to destroy it, those were the data links. And as far as the balloons are concerned, anything you launch in a balloon has to be, quote, engine digestible. Sooner or later, it's going to get hit by a plane, and it goddamn well better lose that battle.
Okay, yeah, I can see where that's very, 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 very important.
So, payloads, the components of the payloads, APR, track, I know that they use APR S-IS, CWP-IS, and OGN. Don't want to go too deep to it. But actually, APRS is a digital communication system that uses packet radio to send real-time tactical information. Yeah, well, on Earth, there would be amateur radio frequencies that we use. And those information are shared for in the network for coordinates, altitude, speed, heading, text messages, alerts, what else? Announcement, bulletins, and weather data. That was W4APR. The Bob Bruninga, I believe. Do you recall that guy? That was the guy who invented APRS.
Yeah, I hear his name whenever people argue and complain what APRS stands for.
Okay. And then we have Aurora, L-O-R-A. So that would be radio modulation technique combined with data encoding technique that gives a broadband spectrum radio to receive sensitivity over very narrow band long range radio. In particular, that for ham radio would be spread spectrum modulation technique from CHIRP. Do I pronounce it properly? CHIRP, CHIRP.
Yes, the CHIRP rate spread spectrum. By the way, APRS, I'm just playing with radio stuff.
Go ahead.
No, seriously, what was the question about spread spectrum?
Yeah, the question is what frequencies that they were using, the payload.
Well, so you're saying it was not a military thing. They're not doing it for low detection. They're using it like the GPS does, narrowing the effective bandwidth by using a spread spectrum with a chip rate, right?
Dr. Roy, do you recall from that video what frequency they might be using?
No, I don't recall. I thought Laura uses public access something around 900 megahertz.
Anyone have information about it?
NY2A.
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the 900 megahertz range, and if you want to know about Laura, there is a Swiss ham that has a YouTube channel, and he covers every aspect of Laura. I think his YouTube channel is his name, Andrea Spice. It's S-P-E-I-S-S, I believe. If you're interested in looking into Laura, he's the man to look at.
By the way, Google is always our friend, and according to Google, it's 915 megahertz in North America. Europe uses 868. I think Asia uses 433 and 169.
Okay, so next question that I have, it's a puzzle. Actually, I didn't check it, to be honest. I'm in physics. I didn't check it. So we have a helium balloon with all of the payload, right? It was like a line. And then in case the balloon blow up, there is a parachute that open up and the payload can be recovered. Now, Dr. Roy, what altitude approximately the helium balloon must blow up because it was very high, and why? Answer it.
As it gets higher, it expands because the pressure is lower on the outside. So the balloon gets stretched tighter and tighter and tighter until it goes beyond its plasticity. And so it ruptures itself. It pulls itself apart. The exact altitude, not quite sure. I would assume partially it's related to the material that the surface of the balloon is made out of.
Okay. People from different occasions, they put in the sky number of balloons, and it seems that there is no limit how high a helium balloon can go. In reality, there are two major constraints: the strength of the balloon material and Archimedes, I'm not sure if I properly pronounce it, principle. As a balloon ascends, the pressure of the surrounding air drops while the helium inside expands, so that balloon must burst. Okay, how high? That's all. I didn't Google for it, but I assume it's 30 kilometers. So 30 kilometers, we assume 22 miles, depending on ambient air quality. Would that look like approximate, Dr. Roy?
Yeah, I Googled it as well. The number that Google seems to like is approximately 20 miles above the Earth's surface. That's where it'll either burst or it will reach equilibrium with the density of the air surrounding it.
Okay, so they put the balloon on air. They had the crew from two clubs, K5, DRK, and K5. RWK, and I assume that was enough to put that balloon approximately 200 miles, 300 miles. No, it looks more than that, off-site, and they were able, due to analytics, to find where it is. So it was landed on the private property. Do you recall some of that?
No, unfortunately not, Leslie. I think I watched it something like midweek, and by now the details are rather fuzzy.
Okay, so it landed. It wasn't very, very long, very long on the sky. So we assume next morning, about 200 miles away, was the balloon was recovered. It was a huge land owned by a farmer, and the farmer with the fence on it, and the farmer not only allowed them to get there with the trucks, well, they had something like four wheels, but he took his own truck, and after searching it, he delivered it to the operator. So that was the story about this one. And we have a last one. Okay. The last one was tipped over crank-up antenna mast. The video details the tilt over crank-up antenna mast that was 27 feet low noise vertical antenna. In the video, it explains some details of the construction and the deployment of the antenna design, and is quite interesting. So I call it crazy, because he first tried that antenna on the back of his four wheels. Do you recall that?
Yes, I did.
So I didn't understand why he didn't put it on the this destination place. Why did he put it on his four wheels, knowing that he's not gonna go anywhere with it? Back to you.
Well, I don't know. I made the assumption that the guy was doing a demonstration, and this was the most convenient way for him to accomplish that.
So it was all the guy. So what he did is he made something like a cross with the pivot with the screw in the middle, and one side of the horizontal cross, so the horizontal cross was the actual antenna. But actually, it was a tubing that has a hole inside, so you could slide inside that tubing, that huge, humongous 27 feet. Well, humongous, not 20, but it's huge dipole. And then the opposite side of the horizontal tube, he attached to the end of it a rope, and that rope was connected to the pulley that was below. So we might see like we have a crest in the air, right? But we can actually change the position of that horizontal part. And he was cranking it like a typical crank, but maybe you, Dr. Roy, can explain it better.
No, I really didn't go into the mechanics. I just kind of watched it as a demo. Curious guy. Seemed to be a little flustered at times. Terrible audio at times. I don't know. It kind of was somewhat a Rube Goldberg invention in many aspects. But, you know, I mean, it was obvious the guy was incredibly proud of it.
Well, I see some of his writing. The metal tubing for the mast and base support galvanized fence tubing from the local fence supply business. I used 3 inches diameter tubing from the base, and the first section at the first section of the mast. Smaller telescopic lens were used to bring the original mast, not in this video, up to 35 feet up. The current metal tubing on the mast extends 13 feet, and 27 feet fiberglass antenna sits on the top. The winch crank was DL 1300A that was winch from Dutton, which was 1,300 pounds working load. Okay.